Blog Talk Radio.
I'm a truth terrorist. I'm a knowledge gangster. I'm a black history hitman. I'm a lie killer, urban gorilla. I gotta be a roughneck.
Free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for free the Black Panthers. And fuck the black police. That 13th Amendment, trying to make a slave of me. You can lock my body, can't trap my mind, not forever be free.
Okay,
free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for free the Black Panthers, and fuck the black police. Feds infiltrated our movements for black leadership roles. But we still here, finna build here, fuck coin tail pro.
Show,
they got me started, lying hearted, I'm the new Mufasa. And I'm all about Umoja, first in Gruz Usaba. Let's bring back the black families, we need our father. Single mama, son and daughter, that's root of the problem. Wise up, we wise up, unity so powerful. Black banks, black schools, black owned, black power moves. You telling lies, you think this shit gon' be televised. Black power, be scared guys, that be standing there like they paralyzed, huh? We say fuck the system, cause we above the system. We keep ARs and pistols, shotguns that's worth the crystal. But that's for self-defense, make sure we have no issues. Be sure to leave it at the door if you have it with you. This for them freedom fighters, that lost their freedom. Until they freedom, we screaming carpe diem. This for the general, King Khalid Muhammad. We gon' make your day a holiday, I fucking promise.
Free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for free the Black Panthers, and fuck the black police. That 13th Amendment, tryna make a slave of me. You can lock my body, can't trap my mind, not forever be free.
Okay,
free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for free the Black Panthers, and fuck the black police. Feds infiltrated our movements for black leadership roles. But we still here, finna build here, fuck coin tail pro.
RBG, 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 RBG. My sisters, my brothers, the council, the elders, shit, that's really all I need. We suited, we booted, don't do it, you stupid, we head to the armory. Black woman and goddess, regardless, my heart just don't fuck with misogyny. Bullshit, I don't tolerate it. Melanated, so you gotta hate it. Barack fucked up another conversation. Trump finna get inaugurated, damn. Unify or die, NBPP.org.
First and foremost, the new Black Panther Party, no other Black Panther Party, we are not violent. We are for self-defense and self-determination. The most violent group in this country are the police. What is taking place by the police department to black people across this country is ethnic cleansing and genocide. It has escalated since the day that Barack Obama was inaugurated in 2008. We have a people who are only 13% of the population, yet we make up 80% of the prisons. We have 50% unemployment rate in the black community, and it's actually even more than that because they're not counting our people that are in the prison. The 13th Amendment says you cannot be made a slave or indentured servant unless you commit a crime. The 14th Amendment forced our people to be subjects of this government. We never had any say in that. We need our own nation.
We need more linear thinking at this point. Oh, yes. Does that mean that we forget the intuition? Not at all. Does that mean we forget the oral tradition? Not at all. But it means then that while maintaining those traditions, we also must enhance other aspects of our personality. We want to look a bit at culture. What is culture? And we should ask this again. I admire Chancellor Williams very much. And I think the destruction of black civilization, of course, is a magnificent book. And I've said many times, though, I think many people read it incorrectly. They read it as history, which it really is not, per se. It is, as he stated very clearly, a set of case studies. An analysis of African culture and of African history with the question in mind, in what way did these cultures or this history advance our interests in as a people? And in what way did this history fail us as a people as well? And we have to look at it that way. What were the problems represented by African cultures such that we permitted ourselves to be overrun by Europeans and we find ourselves in the situation that we find ourselves tonight? Understand? It's no insult for us to ask that question of ourselves. And it's no insult for us to look critically at African history and culture and to be critical of it. It is only through our being critical of our history and our culture that we can advance our interests as a people and survive as a people. Looking at the question, what is culture? Horton and Hunt said, from their life experiences, a group develops a set of rules and procedures for meeting their needs. The set of rules and procedures, together with a supporting set of ideas and values, is called a culture. To a great extent, you see, a culture involves a set of rules and a procedure for meeting needs. And this is the thing we have to keep in mind. You don't have a culture just to have a culture. And you don't claim a culture just because it's a culture or just because it's African. The ultimate thing that culture must do is solve problems. That's why people evolve a culture. That's why a culture comes into existence as a way of what? Solving problems and meeting needs. That's why, at a certain point, when a culture no longer meets the needs of a people or solves the problem confronting a people, that culture must be transformed. There's nothing sacred about holding a culture in the face of, you know, new events and new changes. Unless, of course, you're free to do that if you're willing also to accept suicide or death. And you have that right to that choice. You know, I tell people, you know, we have the right to say, look, we're going to hold on to this culture even if it kills us. But we should be what? Very conscious of our decision. We should not be holding on to it out of a misunderstanding of what culture is supposed to do. Ultimately, culture is supposed to solve problems and to meet the needs of the people. And a culture then has to be measured against those standards. Does this culture meet our needs? Does it solve our problems? Chancellor Weaver, in a sense, then looked at the African cultures, looked at African characteristics, and looked at them in terms of, in what way did they meet our needs, and in what way did they deal with the slave trade and colonialism and the other kind of things that happened to us as African people. And after going through that, then he set up what? The plan, which a lot of people don't read. Which is the whole point of what? It's the whole point of the book. Not the first part, but really the second part. Looking at our culture and our history critically, he then, and looking at our situation and where we are today as a result of that history and of those cultures, he then draws out a map for a plan, a way for us to what? Get out of our situation and to restore African civilization and to restore African people. But it's at that point most people sort of move on to something else. Mm-mm. This is the place you must study. We're going to include that in our power of studies, by the way, that plan along with some others. The sets and rules and procedures together with a supporting set of ideas. Cultures are not just ways people sing and dance and what they eat and how they dress and the rituals and so forth that they perform. These ways of behaving and dressing and so forth are based on sets of ideas and values. And ultimately, in a deeper sense, it's this set of ideals and values that lay the basis for culture. Clarkhorn, an anthropologist, indicated that culture and he defined culture as all the historically created designs for living, explicit and implicit, rational, irrational, and non-rational, which may exist at any given time as potential guides for the behavior of man, for the behavior of the people. In other words, culture creates designs as a result of its history for living and provides guides for its members, guides for behaving. As a set of the guides for designing, for guiding the behavior of its members, a culture provides standards of proper cognitive, emotional, and behavioral conduct. Culture provides a set of norms and concepts of what is to be expected to exist, why we expect them to exist. Though culture is a product of actual experience, culture is essentially ideological, meaning that it essentially exists in the mind, because culture ultimately is based on the sharing of beliefs and customs and expectations. We receive our culture as a result of, as a part of our social heritage. To the degree that the individual identifies or is at one with this culture, and to the degree to which the members of a culture identify with it, culture is represented in the minds of its people. In other words, we have to recognize deeply that culture cannot exist outside of ourselves. It only can exist in our minds and in our bodies as a people. And therefore, to a great extent, it is ideological more than it is physical, more than it is behavioral, more than it is just ways of dressing. Ultimately, a culture must be represented in the very minds of a people. And it is only through its representation as a mental entity that a people can identify with the culture. A culture is a way of thinking, a way of attending the world, of perceiving the world, of classifying and categorizing the world, of ordering the world, of processing information, and of evaluating the world. When we say then that the Europeans decultured us or distorted our culture, we are also saying then that the Europeans have distorted our modes of attending the world, our modes of experiencing the world, our modes of classifying and categorizing the world, our modes of processing information that comes from the world. So there's no little wonder then that we are having problems in what some people call education, particularly as it is European, Eurocentrically designed, that our children are perceived as having problems in thinking skills and math skills and science skills and so forth. Because ultimately, you see, culture provides you with a frame for thinking. It provides you with a structure for organizing information, for classifying information, for evaluating information, you see, for processing information. And when you distort a people's culture, then you distort their capacity to appropriately organize information and deal with it. And this is what has happened to us. This is the reason why I say again and again that the problem of education in terms of the problems our children have in schools are not education problems. They are political. They only express themselves as educational problems. The problems our children may have in paying attention, thinking so-called logically, categorizing, classifying, in terms of vocabulary and so forth, are really not academic problems. They are cultural problems, and they are the result of political interactions. Because in transforming our sense of who we are and what we are, and in transforming our culture, so was our thinking and so forth transformed as well. This is why ultimately the educational problems of our people will have to be solved in terms of cultural transformation, not just in terms of educational technique, you see. And this is what the whites try to lay on us. You know, we're going to discover finally that great reading technique. Children can learn almost in any way you teach them. But it's about more than technique. It must be a part of a total cultural structure. And the children must come with a cultural intentionality because no technique is going to matter if they pay no mind, if they have no interest. You see, if their culture has given them little or no reason for learning what is to be taught, if what they're learning is really not relevant to their situation and their circumstances. And so we have to understand very much how culture itself structures the thought processes. Now, there are some of you who are saying, but there are those of us who knew nothing about African culture and we got all A's in school and so forth and so on. Remember this, though. We got these A's in school and we went through these schools at the price of alienation. As the gentleman who's Carter G. Woodson wrote about the fact that it took him, what, 30 years to get over that Eurocentric education? What is he talking about? To a degree, without that African-centeredness, without that African sense of culture, without an African-centered intentionality that determined why he was learning and for what reason he was learning and how he was going to use his learning in the interest of African people, he adopted an alien culture, as many educated blacks have had to do. In adopting the alien culture and adopting the alien outlook and adopting alien values and so forth, they adopted then a thought framework, you see, that allowed so-called what? Success within the European academic system, you see. But the unfortunate thing about it is, once you adopt that structure and that mode and orientation of thinking, you can only work within it. And so you can keep your ability to think abstractly and logically and scientifically only if you work for us as a what? As a scientist. But you cannot take that thought and what? Outside of that structure and use it in your own interest. And this is the dilemma that many of those who so-called succeeded in this system have had to face. You see, I categorize and I classify, but I categorize and I classify in terms of European structures, and I find that I'm only comfortable in what? Working within those structures. And I can only what? Advance those structures. The European system has this economic system set up in such a way that when you try to use this structured kind of thought outside of the system, it won't pay you. Yeah, it will punish you. And often your own group has problems with it, because our group only pays preachers. But it would rarely pay anyone else that tries to operate in its interest. And so you get caught up in two worlds. Socially, culture patterns the ways in which its members relate to each other, interact with each other, perceive each other, and the ways they organize, develop, institutionalize, and apply their human potential in order to adapt to the conditions in which they live to satisfy psychological and social survival needs. Ultimately, as I said again and again, culture is about solving problems. But we're going to learn, as I've indicated before, solving problems in a cultural way, creating power in a cultural way, requires relating to each other in a particular sort of way, implies interacting with each other in a particular sort of way and perceiving each other in a particular sort of way. I've indicated under other circumstances that individuals do not have power. Power is the result of the nature of social relations between people. The way people choose to interact with each other makes power. If you don't believe it, you can go back a few years and see how little white boys could order grown black men around. Were they big enough to beat them? Were they big enough? Did they have enough power to knock them down? No, they didn't. But it was because those little white kids were in a, what, structured framework, and had behind them, what, a set of structures and strategies that because white people had chosen to relate to each other in a particular way and interact with each other in a particular way, had interact with us in a particular way, even a white child could come out and express power over black folk. But the power was not what? Inherent in the child. But it was inherent in the culture and inherent in how that culture was designed and structured. And it's out of this, and this is what I've told you before about an economic system. An economic system is not the mere existence of money. Economic systems existed prior to money. Money as an instrument of economy has come late in the history of man. And yet we've had economies for hundreds and thousands of years before money came into existence. So ultimately then, an economy must have something to do with the way people choose to cooperate with each other and relate to each other. It is out of this that an economy develops, and it's out of this that power develops, you see. So if you have a culture, the culture is going to provide patterns of relating and interacting. It's these patterns of relating and interacting that permits a people who belong to a culture to solve the problems that confront them. So you see, again, it's just not something, is just to indicate that you wear, you see, or the speech that you make, you see. It ultimately has to be about relating in a particular structured sort of way. This is what culture is socially. It is very important to keep in mind that a culture is, to a significant extent, a historical product. Let's talk a second about identity. Identity is the social and personal outcome of the or product of an identification process. According to Bandura, this identification process is a process in which new responses are acquired and existing repertoires of behaviors are modified to some extent as a result of subjection to direct or indirect conditioning procedures. All cultures condition the people that belong to them. All cultures ultimately must have some means of rewarding and punishing behavior. And that's another thing we don't want to face, you know. We want everybody to do right just because it means doing right. And this is what I said earlier when we talk about these conspiracies and these the boule. You're not going to win this game if you don't have a means of neutralizing people and rewarding people, you see, and controlling people. The reason why, as I've often said, the very first thing that we must do if we are to transform our children is to get control of them. Yeah. And we must become their primary rewarders and punishers. We must determine the conditions under which they are socialized if we want to create the kinds of people we need to solve our problems. You are not going to solve your problems giving the control of your children over to other people. And yet we sit around here hoping every day, after pushing our children and ourselves into the faces of white folk, into the faces of our enemies, that these people, by luck or some means, will happen to be the kind of people we need for ourselves. The very point and process of education is to create the people you need for your benefit. And if a culture is going to educate your children, it then will educate them to benefit whom? Itself, not you. Not you. You must bring your children under your own control, and you must be in control of the conditioning process. This is what it's about. If you don't have control of that, then really you're not going to have control of the children. Because identification with a culture, becoming cultured or enculturated, is the result of a culture approving and disapproving, of rewarding not rewarding, and of sometimes even punishing, to ultimately shape the individual in a way that it benefits the culture and ultimately the individual, him or herself. And this is what identity is about. It's about the patterning of thoughts, feelings, and actions after other persons who serve as models. You even learn to love. You know, we think that love is something natural, just flows out of us automatically. And yet we have a number of cultures who did not base marriage and these other things, as I've told you before, on romantic love. Mm-mm. Even romantic love is taught and learned. Yeah. Yeah. People are taught how to feel. And we do it all the time. You shouldn't feel that way. You should feel ashamed of yourself for thinking this way, for behaving this way. And we're so unconscious, we don't even recognize it, you see. But we are doing what? We are dictating what? Feelings, thoughts, emotions. What is love? The kids hear it all day long in their records, right? The chill run up my spine. I can't get him out of my mind. I can't eat. I can't sleep. I can't... But all this is what? Defining what? This is the way you feel if you're in what? If you're in love, you see. And when you got that feeling, then you can do some other things. You know, and you can, you know, make all kind of commitments based on that. But many cultures have built marriage and family and other things on different modes of thinking and behavior other than that. And when you study the history of romantic love, when this type of love approach and this type of approach for building families and so forth first started coming up, there were many people who thought it was just a sign of madness, of sickness, of a precarious basis upon which to build family and culture, you see. But what we're trying to illustrate here is that culture, to a good extent through its conditioning processes and other processes, through providing models, helps people to pattern their ways of thinking and feeling and behaving and pattern attitudes. Both the conditioning procedures and contingencies and the models are provided by culture. And of course, we recognize that it's one of our major problems today, that often the models that we want to exhibit before ourselves and our children, and often the means by which we can reward our children's behavior, have not been placed in our hands. That another culture has control of the conditioning mechanism and has control of the models that our by which our children are socialized. We must recognize again then, if we are serious about enculturating our people and enculturating our children, then we must gain the means by which we have to condition their enculturation. We must gain the capacity to reward, to punish, and to reinforce, to model the kind of behavior for our children and ourselves that we need to model. Identity is achieved when, as a result of having undergone the identification process, the individual comes to perceive himself as possessing a distinct and unique character or personality, as being a person in his own right, as being able to answer the questions to his own satisfaction, who am I? What am I, and what do I do with my life? Identity, to the extent that it is a cultural product, and identity is a cultural product, and I want to emphasize this because, you see, in this society, we stress individualism. Mm-hmm. And I try to get across to people all the time that in reality, there's no such thing as an individual. That is a social fiction. It is a type of label we use, but it does not exist in reality. That the individual, the thing that we call an individual, is really a synthesis of social experience, a unique combination of our having interacted with others and having undergone social experiences, and it's our unique way of expressing our social relations and our experiences. But who we are and what we are is the result of social relations. It is not something that is completely what? Unique to us and not shared on some level with others. The very fact that you speak a language means that you have a shared identity on some level. If you were completely individual, no one would be able to understand what you were saying. You see? You cannot fit into what? An ordered system and in an ordered society. If you want to imagine to be, you can be a complete individual if you are in space all by yourself. But then what would be the point? It would have no what? No meaning. It would be pointless. Even the concept of individual can only achieve its definition within a social structure. It only has meaning within a social structure and within in terms of relating socially to someone else. Otherwise, it is pointless. It is the social that creates the individual, not the other way around. And yet those who rule over us, you see, will have us think that we can be individuals in and of ourselves and by ourselves without any connection whatsoever to anyone else. And in that way, of course, it can maintain the disunity of our culture and maintain our disunity as a people and ultimately destroy us as a people. So identity is a cultural product. It is the incarnation of a cultural ideology, ecology, and of cultural practice. Identity is culture made flesh. Identity is an instrument for the expression of cultural power. Yes. When an individual identifies with a culture, and remember we said culture is ultimately contained what? In us. Then the individual becomes the what? Instrument of that culture. You see? And this is what I tried to tell you some lectures ago when I talked about manhood, right? When I told you that manhood is a social definition, and to be a man is to be socially defined, so that in expressing what it means to be a man, in defending one's manhood, one also does what? Expresses one's culture and defends what? The culture. And in defending the honor of one's manhood, one defends what? The honor of the culture and the honor of the people. And therefore, ultimately, manhood is an expression of the culture, not of a chauvinistic wish on the part of a male. It is not to be defined in isolation and detached from the needs of the culture itself. That when manhood becomes defined, detached from the needs of the culture itself, detached from the needs of people itself, when boys are not trained into men relative to the culture, then these boys will prey upon the culture and destroy the culture. And this is a part of what we have in so-called black-on-black violence. Boys who've been bought into manhood in ways that are detached from African culture and African people, you see, who have not engaged in training.
Extinction, decomposition, coming up from the animal's life was just a matter of fact. It was just a part of the daily routine. For 2,000 years, the white man and white woman lived in the caves and hills of Europe, roped, found, confined in Europe, living worse than in the Dark Ages. He did his number one in the cave.
All right.
You know what number one is. He did his number two in the cave, too. So for 2,000 years in that same cave, he did his number one. For 2,000 years in that same cave, he did his number two. Can you imagine walking around in your number one and your number two, generation after generation? Can you imagine not just walking around in your number two, but can you imagine lying down to go to sleep every night right there in your urination and your defecation? That's what they did for 2,000 years in the caves and hills of Europe. For 2,000 years, that's what they did. And today they still like their meat raw. Don't they? Some of you go to the restaurants, you try to act like white folks, don't know what the hell you're doing. You haven't even been to that kind of fancy restaurant before. You're trying to show off. You know how you can fix them big, beautiful, thick African lips all to the side and get proper when you like to get proper. You're trying to listen to the white folks at the next table so you can decide what you go on. And they say, I'll have a prime rib end cut. You say, yeah, that sounds like that's pretty good. So you think you cool, you straight now. But then the waiter asks the next question. How would you like that, sir? How would you like that, ma'am? And you heard the white folks say, I'll have mine red. You say, well, hell, that must mean it's a real special kind of snake, a steak. If it's rare, must not be no more steaks like that one in the whole restaurant. So I got to show off for my lady, so I'm going to get a rare in-cut prime rib that ain't got no more cuts like that, because it's rare. It must be a special steak. And so you sitting there proper, waiting, holding your cancer stick in your hand, puffing on a poison nicotine weed that the goddamn white man gave you, found on one end and a fool on the other end of the cigarette. You sitting there waiting, and they bring it with the blood all in the plate, and then you lose your coolness. You ain't proper no more. You lose all of that. I don't want this here. What you bring me this here for with all this blood? I don't want this. With all this, I thought it was rare. He said, well, sir, or ma'am, it is rare. They still eat their meat raw today. They like to eat it with the blood running out. They like to taste the blood. They got blood pies. They got blood pudding. They got a pudding called boudin. Blood. And they sit down and eat it like it's Hunt's or Heinz tomato sauce. Big tablespoon of blood. Say, isn't it great, honey? She said, yes, it's wonderful. Pass me the escargot. That's another thing they hang you up on. They say, our special today is escargot ugohukishi. You don't know what the hell it is. Bring it to you and you find out it's nails and them African lips get straight then. You're not proper anymore then. You're not holding that little, you know how you can hold that little finger up when you're trying to get proper? I don't want no damn snails. I don't eat no snails. Crawling white folks love snails. They even have another delicacy that they call mountain oysters. That's the male organ of the bull. Sex organ of the bull. They eat the bull, the male bull genitalia on a plate with a fork and a knife and some salt and pepper. And call it a delicacy. And you sitting right there eating with them. You want a rattlesnake steak. These people did this for 2,000 years in the caves and hillsides of Europe. They crawled around on their all fours. That's why our dear brothers in this house, who we love and respect, they should be here at this meeting today. We love them. The Grand Master of this lodge should be sitting right up here. We have a special seat for the Grand Master, the Imperial Grand Potentate. We got a seat for all of them, the daughters of Jericho and the Herons of Jericho and the Eastern Star. We got a special place for them because they are following after the white man's order and not after their own. They have 32 degrees, is that right? 32 degrees. But they say that they are upright on the square. Been raised from a dead level to a living perpendicular upright on the square. In order to be upright on the square, you must have a 90-degree angle. Is that right? It must be a 90-degree angle to be upright on the square. Half of that is what? Is a 45-degree angle. Is that right? 45-degree angle. But now here's the people who say they're upright on the square. And they got 32 degrees. Somewhere down here, and 32 degrees is freezing on the Fahrenheit scale. Then they get an honorary degree, the 33rd degree, and they go into the Shriners. And they name their lodges Mecca Lodge, Medina Lodge, Muhammad Lodge, Elijah Lodge, Quran Lodge. These are white folks, white presidents, are members of the Quran Lodge, the Muhammad Lodge, the Mecca Lodge, the Medina Lodge. Did you know that? White judges, whites who are in corporate America, even white straw-chewing, tobacco-chewing, snuff-dipping, overall-wearing peckers down in the deep south that will call us a nigger in a minute. They believe in masonry, and they are members of Quran Lodge and Muhammad Lodge and Mecca Lodge and all of these lodges. And they wear a fez with a black tassel on it. A red fez with a black tassel on it. With a star and crescent like this one turned upside down. Not right side up, but upside down. With a sword running through. You see them wearing it in diamonds in their lapel with a sword running through. The sword is there to remind the white man. You have robbed the black man and the black woman of their name, their language, their religion, their culture, their God, their folkways, their mores, their norms, and robbed them of the very power of their own being. And if you ever let the black man know who he really is, if you ever let the secret leak out of who the black woman really is, if they ever know who they really are, you will never be able to control them again. So that will be the hour of the resurrection of the dead, the rise of the black nation, and the fall and the demise of the white man. So they can't let you know who you are. Crazy people. They can't let you know who you are. That you are actually a god, black man, and you are actually a goddess, black woman, and we are all children of the Most High God. You can read it in the 82nd chapter of the book of Psalms. Ye are gods, all of you children of the Most High God. It says, arise, O God. That's the 82nd chapter of Psalms. Then they contend with Jesus. You know Jesus, right? Jesus, that's the black revolutionary Messiah. Who is he? Now some of you can't say that because you're so used to a blonde hair, blue eyed, pale skin, buttermilk complexion, peckerwood up in the stained glass windows of your church. Here you are, blacker than the ace of spades. Some of you so black and beautiful until you blue black, purple black and beautiful. Some of you so black until you blacker than 150 million midnights. Hair so nappy and beautiful until it looks like a million black power fists standing up on top of your head. But you go to a church with a white Jesus, a white Mary, am I lying? Tell the truth and shame the devil. White angels with a white robe on and some white chicken wings. Some of you even believe God is white and you can't see him, you see. You believe the angels are white. When you close your eyes to pray, you see a white man. Oh, Lord, help me get out of this jail. They done gave me 40 years. And you see a white man in your mind that looks just like the white man that gave you the damn 40 years. How you gonna get out? Get out. Oh, Lord, the rent is due. Got a red notice on the phone, a red notice on the gas, a red notice on the light. The refrigerator is empty. Oh, Lord, please help me. And you see a white man in your mind who looks like the white man down at the water and power department who's going to turn the lights off. White man in your mind that looks just like the white man down there who's going to turn the gas off. Looks just like the other white man who's going to authorize the marshals to come and set your stuff out on the street. You look, he looks just like the white man that's going to serve you notice to get out of his house. The scriptures say he or she who calls on the name of the Lord God shall be saved. So the question is, have we been calling on the right name of God? Have we been calling on the right God?
The fraternity of policemen. He said that the policeman is God. That's what he said. There's a devil saying that the policeman is God. He's judge, jury, and executor. Huh? Right on the spot. He talked about how he used to beat black men and women and Chicano brothers and sisters until he would just beat the waste out of them, beat the mess out of them. He said, then you could smell the niggas and the Mexicans or the Chicano. You could smell them. I mean, you could smell them stinking. He said you couldn't get into the jail for the stench coming from them. They just beat them until they urinate on themselves, beat them until their bowels would waste all over. He said he'd grab them and just throw them down the steps, just throw them down. And another cracker down at the other end of the steps, or catch them at the other end of the steps, kick them and beat them. No, you got to, I'm here to tell you that the only way you're going to stop police brutality is you got to stand up and be brutal with this damn beast. You got to step to this cracker or it will never stop. You can moan, you can groan, you can sing, you can pray. You can recite, you can claim you know all the Quran, Old Testament. All the Bible, Old Testament, New Testament, the Quran from Al-Fatiha to Al-Nas. You can know all the Medunetah. You can know Maya, truth, justice, righteousness, harmony, balance, order, reciprocity. You can name those of the Netter system. You can go and study the Odu text and substantiate your position according to Odu. You can study the Ifa or the Word or the Akan or the Yoruba and run through the pantheon of the Orisha. You can call on Oludumare. You can call on Ilegba and Shango and Obatula and Oshun and Ogun and Yemonya. You can know all of that. But unless you're willing to stand up and step to this white man, we will never get out of this condition. Frederick Douglass said the limits of a tyrant is prescribed by exactly how far you will let that tyrant go. He won't stop if you don't stop him. It's like any bully. The bully will keep picking on you until you get him to raise up off of you. Some of us will lose our lives. Tupac is gone already. Biggie is gone already. Many of us, Yusuf Hawkins is gone already. Many of us are already dead and we're dying every day. And while we're here in Queens tonight, black men and women and young black boys are dying at the hands of some cracker somewhere in America right now. I would rather die for a cause than to die because you in some barroom pinching somebody's wife on the booty on the bar stool and get your throat cut with a Miller Lite bottle. It's a hell of a life, man. That's a hell of a way to go. Say, your daddy got killed. Say, yeah. How'd he get killed? Say, he pinched somebody's wife on the booty at the bar stool. The dude picked up a Miller Lite bottle of Budweiser Light and broke it and cut his throat. Is that the way he died? Well, he died in the East Coast, West Coast fight. East Coast? West Coast? You a damn fool. You'll die over some bullshit? Some damn records? A damn CD? You are what you call a recording studio gangster? Oh, you bad as hell in the recording studio. Ain't a nigga in the world better than you. Capone couldn't mess with you. Babyface Nelson. None of them couldn't mess with you. A recording studio gangster. You just as bad as you can be. You gon' blow, put your gat in the nigga's mouth and blow the nigga's brains out. I'll stomp that hoe. I'll kick that bitch. White man, show up. You can hear a rat pee on cut. Nigga ain't ready to fight. Nigga ain't ready to fight. I say we must arm the masses. Most of y'all got guns anyway. You shoot them for the 4th of July. Damn day that ain't even your Independence Day. Yes, you do. You shoot them on New Year's and New Year ain't in yet. You just got them. They're just toys. Or you'll go get them on your wife. Draw the gun on her because she burnt the beans for the 4th time. She'll just go order some beans. Or she'll draw the pistol on you because the phone rang at 2 in the morning and you stayed on too long talking too low. Two or three brothers so bad. I'm Crip. Two or three brothers so bad. I'm Blood. They'll go off into territory of their rival brother gang and face bumper jacks, face chains, baseball bats, pipes, nines, AKs, face everything in a fratricidal war with your kith and kin, your flesh and blood, your brother, your sister. Goddamn white man come, you throw the guns under the damn car, throw the damn guns in the bushes, he make 50 niggas spread up against the wall, one peck of wood. Alright, get up against the wall, buddy. Don't move, guy. Here's Will Kill Johnson. Here's Bloody Blood. All them crazy names you got. Here's Shotgun. All of them spread up against the wall.
To our program for the future.
Economy right now. It's extremely supporting of the president and his
policy. FBI scientists have found chemical traces consistent with a bomb or a missile on a piece of wreckage. Police using clubs and tear gas against demonstrators.
Mother so-and-so and a white fascist. Like they said, you're getting some of your own medicine.
Then the rest will fall behind. Tell me who's got control of your mind, your worldview. Is it the news or the movie you taking your girl to? Know what I'm saying, cause Uncle Sam got a plan. If you examine what they telling us, then you will understand what they planting in the seeds of the next generation. Feeding our children miseducation. No one knows if there's UFOs or any life on Mars, or what they doing when they up in the stars. Because I don't believe a word of what the president said. He's filling our heads with lies, got us hypnotized when he be speaking in cold words about crime and poverty, drugs, welfare, prisons, guns, and robbery. It really means us. There's no excuse for the slander, but what's good for the goose is still good for the gander, see?
I don't believe Bob Marley got the cancer. 31 years ago, I would have been a panther. They killed Huey because they knew he had the answer. The views that you see in the news is propaganda. I don't want no computer chip in my arm. I don't wanna die by a nuclear bomb. I said we all rush the Pentagon.
pull out guns and grab the intercom. My first words would be, I believe man made God out of ignorance and fear. If God made man, then why the hell would he put us here? I thought he supposed to be the all-loving, the same God who let Hitler put the Jews in the ovens. We don't fall for the regular shit. They try to feed us all this half-assed leadership, flipping position. They turn politician and shut the hell up and follow tradition. Boy, your TV screen telling lies to your vision. Every channel got the brainwash cop shit to watch. Running up in niggas' cribs claiming that they earned shots. Just a plot. But Buster, can you tell me who's greedy are? The big corporation, the pigs or the media. Sign of the time, terrorism on the rise. Commercial airplanes falling out the skies like flies. Make me wonder what secrets went down with Ron Brown, who burned the churches to the ground with no evidence found. It's not coincidence. There's been too many steady incidents. It could have been the Klan who put that bomb at the Olympics, but it probably was the FBI. Deep at the core, cause if they make us all panic, they can start martial law. I don't believe Bob Marley died from cancer. 31 years ago, I would have been a panther. They killed Huey because they knew he had the answer. The views that you see in the news is propaganda. I don't believe Bob Marley died from cancer. 31 years ago, I would have been a panther. You killed Huey because you knew he had the answer. The views that you see in the news is motherfucking propaganda.
Groups understand the system, and with this realization, we attempted to form a strong political base based in the community with the only strength that we have, and that's the strength of a potentially destructive force if we don't get freedom.
By their ancestors to serve the people no longer serves the people, for the people have changed. The people of the 18th century have become the ruling circle of the 20th century. And the people of the 20th century are the descendants of the slaves and the dispossessed of the 18th century. The Constitution set up to serve the people of the 18th century now serves the ruling circle of the 20th century. And the people of today stand wanting for a foundation for their own life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. The civil rights movement has not produced this foundation, and it cannot produce this foundation because of the nature of the United States society and economy. The version of the civil rights movement, the vision of the civil rights movement is to achieve goals which have been altered by 200 years of change. Thus, the civil rights movement and similar movements have produced no foundation for life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. They have produced humiliating programs of welfare and unemployment compensation. Programs with sufficient form to deceive the people, but with insufficient substance to change the fundamental distribution of power and resources in this country. Moreover, while the movements attempt to get minorities into the system, we note that the government continues this pattern of practice which contradicts its democratic rhetoric. We recognize now that we see history repeating itself, but on an international as well as a national scale. The relentless drive to profit led this nation to colonize, oppress, and exploit its minorities. This profit drive took this nation from democratic capitalism and underdevelopment to bureaucratic capitalism and overdevelopment. Now we see that this small ruling circle continues its profit drive by oppressing and exploiting the people of the world. Throughout the world, the proletariat is crushed so that the profits of the American industry can continue to flow. Throughout the world, the freedom struggle of oppressed people are opposed by this government because they are a threat to the bureaucratic capitalism of the United States of America. We gather here to let it be known at home and abroad that a nation conceived in liberty and dedicated to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness has in its maturity become an imperialistic power dedicated to death, oppression, and the pursuit of profit. We will not be deceived by so many of our fellow men. We will not be blinded by small changes in form which lack any change in substance of the imperialist expansion. Our suffering has been too long. Our sacrifices have been too great, and our human dignity is too strong for us to be prudent any longer. The Black Panther Party calls for freedom and power to determine our destiny. The Black Panther Party calls for full employment for all our people. The Black Panther Party calls for an end to the capitalistic exploitation of our community. The Black Panther Party calls for decent housing for all people. The Black Panther Party calls for an educational system that will tell us the true facts about this decadent society. The Black Panther Party calls for exemption from the military service. The Black Panther Party calls for an end to police brutality. The Black Panther Party calls for freedom for all political prisoners and prisoners of war. The Black Panther Party calls for trials by members of our peer when we're brought to the court and justice. The Black Panther Party calls for a United Nations plebiscite to determine the will of black people as to their national destiny. Black people and oppressed people in general have lost faith in leaders of America, in the government of America, and the very structure of the American government, that is the Constitution, its legal foundation. This loss of faith is based upon the overwhelming evidence that this government will not live according to the Constitution because the Constitution is not designed for its people. For this reason, we assemble a constitutional convention to consider rational and positive alternatives. Alternatives which will place the emphasis on the common man. Alternatives which will bring about a new economic system in which the rewards as well as the work will be equally shared by all people. A socialist framework. Alternatives which will guarantee that within the socialist framework, all groups will be adequately represented in decision-making and administration which affect their lives. Alternatives which would guarantee that all men will attain their full manhood rights, that they will be able to live, be free, and seek out those goals which will give them respect and dignity while permitting the same privileges for every other man regardless of his condition or status. The sacredness of man and of the human spirit requires that human dignity and integrity ought to always be respected by every other man. We will sell for nothing less, or at this point in history, anything less is but a living dead. It is a fact that we will get change. We will transform the society. It is up to the oppressor to decide whether this will be a peaceful thing or... We will use whatever means that is effective, regardless of the consequence, because it is our conclusion and our principle that a slave who dies a natural death will not balance two dead flies on the scales of eternity. We will have our manhood, even if we have to level the face of the earth. So I would like to say that we are one tonight. Let us be one in the future. Power to all of the people.
Holler if you hear me. Yeah. Here we go, turn it up, let's start. From block to block, the sassy heart, the jack and muscle. And the punk police can't fake me a mercy. We can have big sun safety. But right now I got my mind set up. Looking down the bottle, I'm but not scared up. Cause it's time to make the payback back. To my brothers on the block, better stay strapped, black. And expect no substitutes. I bring two to the roof, tear the roof of the whole school. Home though, I'm on the turn the other cheek. In case they can't see us, while we burn the other week.
When people discuss the issues in L.A., they want to discuss them only within the context of the time that these disturbances occurred. And they only want to discuss them in terms of the images of people running around in the street and destroying property within that context. And one of the things that the ruling groups in this society always seeks to do is to control time, to control the use of time. And by confining then the discussion to the period of time of the disturbance, then the emphasis is on the actual behavior. And therefore the behavior is not placed within historical context, political and ideological context, and therefore is made to appear all the more irrational and purposeless. Often the events that precipitate a so-called riot or a so-called revolt appears to be somewhat minor, you see, and in and of itself not worthy of the kind of reaction that occurred. But this can only appear to be the case when one ignores the prior history of the disturbance, and one ignores the underlying emotional state, social and political and economic conditions that existed at the time of the disturbance. When one forgets then that the apparently minor occasion which precipitated the reactionary disturbance itself may have been symbolic of a particular set of historical circumstances and symbolic of a particular state of mind. Merely the straw that breaks the camel's back. Because as we say in Black on Black Violence, every act has a history. And it's in that history that we come to understand it. And therefore, we must resist the attempts of those on TV who interview us and so forth to confine the discussion to the mere behavior of the people during the time that that behavior occurred. And we ourselves must look at the history that occurred prior to the event, and more importantly, at the state of mind of the people who precipitated the event or were precipitated by events to engage in that behavior. The preconditions which set the stage, for the Los Angeles and urban revolts have a long history and are many. They include both socioeconomic conditions and the collective mental state of the African-American community. Of the two, the mental state of anxiety and frustration over current and future developments, that state is the more important. It's not the concrete state as much as the perception of the state and the state of mind of a people. The dissatisfied state of mind and the attitude of black people toward our conditions constitute the major factors which precede and underlie urban violence and revolt. So you can't look at the number of people who have achieved middle class status and so forth. You must look at the state of mind of our people and the level of dissatisfactions that exist in our minds as people. The preconditions for the LA revolt, of course, were many. And I'll just name a few of them. We don't have time to go through them all. Some of you might have had a chance to see or read the Atlantic magazine of May 1991. And you see here, of course, the issue of race was its cover story. When the official subject is presidential politics, taxes, welfare, crime, rights, or values, the real subject is race. We have old quail who can't tell the difference between potato and potato talking about traditional values. Another coded word for race, implying that black folk have no values, implying somehow that black mothers and fathers actually tell their children to go out and commit crime. Son, when I want you to grow up, I want you to be the biggest crack dealer on the block. That would just make me so happy. Be a criminal. Drop out of school. You know, what is this man talking about? What is he implying when he tries to imply that there's an absence of so-called values in the black community? Be very suspicious, by the way, of these people who talk about values anyway. We have to ask him, what kind of values did they have to make them rob and steal and destroy the Indians and the enslavement of black people? As I often said about Jimmy Swaggart when he used to talk about that old-time religion. He used to march across that stage with that Bible pumping up and down. Yes, talking about the religion of his great-grandpas and how he wanted that religion brought back. Of course, I have to remind my people, you really don't want that religion brought back. Because at the time they had that religion, they were hanging and lynching black people and enslaving black people. So I definitely don't want that old-time religion. And I'm a little weary about those traditional values he's talking about, too. Because those are apparently the values that underlie the racism of this nation and that rationalizes white supremacy. And that somehow lays the ideological foundations for the mistreatment of African people in America. I am not concerned then about the restoration of their so-called traditional values, but the creation of new values. In this book and in this magazine by Thomas Byrne Edsall and Mary Edsall, they start out the article by stating, race is no longer a straightforward, morally unambiguous force in American politics. Instead, considerations of race are now deeply embedded in the strategy and tactics of politics. In competing concepts of the function and responsibility of government, and in every voter's conceptual structure of moral and partisan identity, we're at the very center and heart of how America defines itself. Race helps define the liberal and conservative ideologies, shapes the presidential coalitions of the Democratic and Republican parties, provides a harsh new dimension to concern over taxes and crime, drives a wedge through alliances of the working classes and the poor, and gives both momentum and vitality to the drive to establish a national majority inclined by income and demography to support policies benefiting the affluent and upper middle class. In terms of policy, race has played a critical role in the creation of a political system that has tolerated, if not supported, the growth of the disparity between rich and poor over the past 15 years. Race-coded images and language changed the course of the 1980, 1984, and 1988 presidential elections and the 1990 elections for the governorships of California and Alabama, the U.S. Senate in North Carolina, and the post of Texas Secretary of Agriculture. The political role of race is subtle and complex, requiring listening to those whose views are deeply repellent to some and deeply resonant for others. The debate over racial policy has been skewed and distorted by a profound failure to listen. And so we see here then that blacks are the scapegoats of this society. African Americans are the means by which this society defines itself. As I say it again on black violence, you see, that the whole of the white ego and the whole of the white self-image is built on its definition of who black people and African people are. That is why it is obsessed by criminalizing African people. Whenever you see a people insisting against all kinds of evidence on negating and scandalizing the personality of another person or another people, you recognize then that they're engaged in those acts to protect their own ego, and that their ego structure is built on maintaining the scandalizing of their targets. And that if they did not have these targets of scandal, if they did not have these egos, these people as scapegoats, their facade and their infrastructure would crumble and fall apart. They would come face to face with the madness and insanity that motivates their personalities and their systems. When blacks move out of our role as scapegoats and redefine ourselves in ways that cannot be denied by any people in the world, then white people will go crazy. And they will fall apart. And we said in Black on Black then that the so-called criminality of black people is an economic and political necessity for maintaining the system. It is not merely an accusation flowing from racial prejudice, nor merely accusation flowing from racial hatred, as hatred has little to do with it. It is necessary to the very foundations of the system itself. And that's why at the center of it, even in the current politics of the day, you will see African people. And how will you deal with African people as a determining factor in terms of who will get elected and who will be given power in this society. It determines who will be called liberal and who will be called conservative. It determines then the support that they will win in this system or will not win. And we have a situation here then where the Democratic Party, in the dastardly behavior of Clinton, is trying to change the perception that the white electorate has of it so that it can gain power by disrespecting black people and by creating bogus issues. And again, it has come to recognize, as is made very clear in this article, which basically lays out a program for the Democratic Party for achieving power in America, by saying you got to learn somehow to disentangle yourself from these black folk. Because in an analysis that you sponsored, a polling firm that you hired found the following. These white Democratic defectors, talking about those, what you call the Reagan Democrats, express a profound distaste for blacks, a sentiment that pervades almost everything they think about government and politics. Blacks constitute the explanation for their white defectors' vulnerability, and for almost everything that has gone wrong in their lives. Not being black is what constitutes being middle class. Not living with blacks is what makes a neighborhood a decent place to live. These sentiments have important implications for Democrats, as virtually all progressive symbols and themes have been redefined in racial and pejorative terms. The special status of blacks is perceived by almost all of these individuals as a serious obstacle to their personal advancement. Indeed, discrimination against whites has become a well-assimilated and ready explanation for their status, vulnerability, and failures. So you see why we got to look at more than whether we've gotten an increase in jobs and whether more of us are in schools and so forth. Because the attitudes that the other people are operating on have little or nothing to do with these sort of things. You read last week where the whites engaging in the buying of weapons is increasing at a faster rate than blacks. And whites engaging in violence is increasing 30% faster than blacks. And as I will talk a bit later on, this speaks to the fact that whites feel extremely vulnerable. They feel under threat. And this implies then that at some point these feelings may boil over into attacks on the black community. For the rationales have already been set. This situation where the election to political office, where gaining the reins of power depends upon one's relationship and attitudes toward blacks, is very serious. It means then that blacks must be subjected to a constant barrage of innuendo and scandal, and that the best way to get over then is by attacking the very integrity and humanity of the black community. And it means then that this attack on the humanity and the integrity of the black community must proceed even at the time when some blacks appear to be making it up in the system. It means that you must even use those blacks who are making it up in the system to join you in the attack on themselves. This is one of the underlying causes. This is one of the preconditions that was there when the DLA insurrection occurred. If you'll read the current Atlantic magazine, which seems to revel in the analysis of African people, they will talk in this current month about the suburban century. They call it the suburban century begins. And what do they mean by that? They're referring to the fact now that the political base of this country lies in the suburban areas. And for the first time in the history of this country, it's the suburbs who carry the weight in terms of votes. It is no longer the large cities which carry the larger percentage of voters. And consequently then, politicians who expect to get elected to office must speak to the suburbs and must cajole those and flatter those who live there. This is why then you're hearing again and again about this neglected middle class, you see, and programs that concern themselves with rehabilitating and restoring the middle class. Another code for we are going to ignore these blacks whom we have locked into these inner cities. And we are not now going to propose any kind of programs for them. We are now going to propose that you are the ones that are in trouble. And we now are going to rescue you from your troubles. You look in many of the publications today talking about edge cities, new cities created principally by whites that ring the inner cities. Cities that now, whose governments are almost under direct control of these white suburbanites. Cities then that have influence in state governments in such a way that they can prevent taxation schemes that are meant to rescue the inner cities, that are meant to change the direction of the miseducation of our children, that are meant to relieve the problems of the inner cities. We have a situation then where whites have organized themselves in such a way that a politician who even talks about the rescue of the cities is literally damned for state office or for higher office. And now you see Clinton and other groups speaking to this suburban fringe. Is this fringe suffering? They tend to think that the black community implicitly or explicitly is not aware of what is going on. Let's look at some of these things, some of these preconditions. By 1991, the federal government's largest housing subsidy program was providing an average of $3,000 a year for each of 6 million wealthiest households in America, while offering nothing to the 36 million Americans in poverty. Only one of every 8 federal benefit dollars actually reaches Americans in poverty. There has been a wholesale rape and robbery of the poor and weak in this country. And yet, this is the class that is supposedly now being rescued and is now supposedly being ministered unto by those who run for office. From 1980 to 1991, in constant dollars, the average federal benefit received by households with incomes under $10,000 declined by 7%. An actual decrease in benefits from the government, but yet we get a lying and deceptive image that because of the fiscal difficulties in this country are those people on welfare, of the burden placed upon the government and upon the treasury by the poor people and by inner city people. And yet these people earning under $10,000 have actually had their monies taken away and not added on to, while the rich and while the middle class have actually fed at the government troughs. On average, households with incomes under $10,000 collected a total of $5,690 in benefits. On average, households with incomes over $100,000 collected $9,280 from the government. In other words, those making over $100,000 collect nearly twice as much from the government as those earning under 10. You see, you'll hear whites in making these discussions and talking about the state of this country and talking about the debt that this country is suffering from. And you can hear them talk about the deficit and the threat that this deficit holds for the health of this nation. And I want to warn you that this nation is in a very precarious state of circumstances. And the precariousness of its state will be made clear after the elections. But if you listen carefully, you can already feel the panic over the concerns of the economic state of this country. They are in such a panic that they know they have to reduce the deficit of this nation if it is to survive and if it is going to be socially viable. In my series on power, I talk about one of the causes of black-on-black violence. Other than the psychology that I referred to earlier, other than the social relations, has to do with the economic state of the black community. I try to emphasize that it's very important from a conceptual point of view to think in terms of a nation within a nation when it comes to analyzing black problems. I am not advocating that you buy the concept that we should have a nation within a nation. So don't give me a knee-jerk reaction right on. What I am saying is just think conceptually in terms of black people as a nation within a nation. I think when you use this concept, it will help you to see some things that perhaps you cannot see through the use of other concepts, such as individualism and the other stuff that people lay on you. When you look at the black community and the African-American community in this country as a nation within a nation, it becomes almost immediately apparent as to why there's so much violence and social disorganization in the black community. I often use the Chinese opium wars to illustrate what I'm talking about, of how the British, in entering trade with the Chinese, were buying all of their tea from China, and China was buying nothing from the British. The British had nothing the Chinese wanted. And yet the British wanted that tea. They were hooked on a tea habit. And the Chinese demanded only silver and gold from the British. And that meant over time that the British balance of payments became unbalanced, because their silver and gold was flowing into China, but nothing, no earnings were coming back from the Chinese, and they were facing a dilemma. They recognized that this situation could not continue, or else they could not maintain their social institutions, and they could not maintain social order in their society, and that their government could not maintain legitimacy, and the people at some point would rise up against it in revolt and refuse to follow its dictates and refuse to pledge allegiance to it and destroy it. Because this is what happens to nations when they have negative flows of wealth. Because it takes wealth to maintain order. It takes wealth to maintain institutions. It takes wealth to maintain employment system. It takes wealth to create jobs. It takes wealth to educate children and so forth. And when that wealth is flowing out into the hands of other people, these institutions collapse. The discipline of the people collapse. The obedience and the habits of obedience collapse, and chaos begins to reign. And the only way governments can maintain power then under those circumstances is often to use martial law and strong martial means of maintaining population control. And that has serious limitations. And the British then recognized that we had to change the situation or else our very society will be destroyed. And what did they do then? They hooked the Chinese into an opium habit and addicted the Chinese, and then demanded of the Chinese, once they got hooked, now you pay us for your opium in silver and gold. And that habit got to such a level that the balance was reversed, and the flow went out of China to England. And when the Chinese tried to stop it, the English government, the old pusher that it is, yes, a government based on drugs. The Queen, the greatest drug pusher the world has ever known, went in like any gangster on these streets out here to protect their monopoly to sell drugs to the Chinese, and engaged in two wars to maintain the drug market that they had established. And yet you try to sit here and listen to these jokers with their moral pieties trying to talk to us. Nation built upon the selling of drugs, and the government coming in defense of the selling of drugs. But my point here is, of course, what happens when you get trade imbalances. And the Chinese recognize, if we don't stop this stuff, our wealth is going to flow out to such a degree until we then will suffer social collapse. Now, when you look then at the African-American communities, surrounded by non-African communities, plagued by economic parasites, coming into its midst and taking its wealth and earnings right out, exploited by white and non-white alike, who rob it of its wealth and rob it of its resources, and who, even in his stupidity, tries to say the answer to this is to increase the number of us with skills and education, only to have those with increased skills and education also what? Shipped out so that they can solve other people's problems and spend their earnings in other people's markets and therefore can't return neither their skills nor their wealth back to the original community. So then what do you have? A community, an African nation with a tremendous trade deficit, with a tremendous trade imbalance, with a tremendous outflow of material resources and capital and brains, and an increasing concentration then of people who are bereft of skills and resources and the like. Violence and social disorganization, family and institutional disorganization becomes inevitable under those circumstances. Am I getting across to you? Because I don't want to hear you talking to me when I tell you that you've got to throw these Koreans out of this community, and you got to throw these Arabs out of this community, and you've got to throw all the rest of these jokers out of this community. Come talk to me about some racial harmony and love and reverse racism and hiding under Islam and some Christian ideology. Because you must recognize the hard, cold fact is you cannot educate your children. You cannot train them in the way they should go. You cannot give them appropriate recreational centers and other things they need without material wealth. And you can't do it by handing it over to other people. And it is not the result of hard feelings or racial hatred against any other people. It is not reverse racism. It is a matter of survival and protecting your own. I do not want to hear any pompous discussions about values and pompous discussion about how parents should teach their children values. Anybody who's lived in the ghettos as long as I have knows that you can teach values day in and day out and still lose your children. Because we live in a world and in a context where we are not the only one that raise our children. We're not the only ones that influence our children. The middle class isn't better at raising children, and it isn't better at projecting values. It is only better at buying neighborhoods. Because when you buy your house, you buy your neighborhood. You buy your school. You buy a set of neighbors. And you buy a social and political context. That is not just the buying of a house. You buy a totality. And you buy a totality that supports your values. Values are little or no account when they are not reinforced by a social system and rewarded by concrete outcomes. How long can one hold on to a value when one is starved with holding on to that value? When one is punished and rejected, even when one demonstrates that one has held on to that value? When then we demand that our children exhibit certain values, then we should be in the position to reward their exhibition of those values. Or else we will look as hypocrites and fools, and we will give them empty and pious sayings that in the long run work against their interests and not for their interests. Half, or at least 400 billion, of all entitlements went to households with incomes over $30,000. Do you hear what I'm saying? $400 billion went to people who earned over $30,000. Talk about your pride, your individual pride and your individual drive and how you got your little house as a result of individual drive, even though you ran down to the Federal Housing Authority to back your mortgage and to back your down payments.
even though you have engaged the federal government to insure your mortgages. And you're going to talk about how independent you were in getting your house. How can the poor then go to the federal government and get it to insure their rent and pay out rent and other costs? Now, you got a government behind you even when you think you're buying that house all by yourself. Even when you think you've scraped and saved and put that down payment on it. When you sit up there and deduct those credits, who do you think stands in and pays the tax? You don't pay. When you write so proudly the deductions that you deserve as a homeowner. When those of us who pay rent and other things cannot make the same claims. Do you think that you are being independent? No, you are not. You are feeding from the federal trough. And you are feeding at the rate of billions from the federal trough. And therefore those, one half of all of those entitlements, $400 billion went to households, 30,000 and above. One quarter, or at least $200 billion, approaching almost the whole spend earning power of black people, went to households with incomes over $50,000. Who is on welfare? Who is dependent? Understand? That's why when you hear them on TV talking about this federal deficit, they'll just mention the word entitlement. Well, we've got to get rid of these entitlement programs. And of course, people read into them, oh, they're talking about those welfare people. You see, they're talking about those Section 8 folk or something like that. And you ask yourself, why do they never discuss what they mean by entitlement? And why is it that despite the tremendous deficit that this country is facing, a deficit that threatens its very viability, those men in the U.S. Senate and House cannot pass bills to straighten that deficit up? They are so gutless and afraid to pass bills and come to terms with a deficit that is threatening the very social foundations of this nation, that they are trying to create a constitutional amendment so that they would be forced to balance the budget against their will, because they know that they can never develop the will to do it. That's the way New York State does it. You know, it's just written in the Constitution. You've got to balance it, period. There's no way around it. The federal government doesn't have this, you see. And so now what the Senate is saying, those people in the Senate are saying, we can't get the guts, despite the threat, to see that this doggone deficit is taken care of. Why can't they get the guts? Is it that they're afraid of welfare people? Are they afraid of welfare rights? Mm-mm. They're afraid of the main welfare people, those suburbanites that they're talking about. Those $50,000 a year people, those $100,000 a year people who are now getting billions of dollars from the federal trough. That's why they can't pass it. Because those are the people with the lobbies. Those are the people who with the organizations. Those are the people with the power. Those are the people who can diselect folk. And so consequently then, they are almost ready to see this country collapse on itself. But you know in the end who's going to be blamed for it, because they keep just using the word entitlement. And the mass population will read entitlement as people on welfare. We're going to have then an attack, a genocidal attack on black folks. What are the long-term preconditions then that set up the L.A. riot besides the ones I mentioned? An interesting piece in the Village Voice called Herbicide by Daniel Lazar points some of them out. Subsidized private housing. You must know, you see, that the government, you notice whenever the government tries to read what they call leading economic indicators as to whether the economy is moving up, or whether the recovery is over, what is the first thing they look at? Housing. Housing and housing starts. Because if you stop for a minute, you recognize the building of houses is attached to so many other industries. You understand? When you buy a house, you're buying furniture, you're buying rugs, you're hiring carpenters, plumbers, you're feeding the brick industry, you're feeding the pipe industry, you're feeding the tile-making industry, the insurance people, there are tons of people that ride on housing. And that's why the government looks at it as a crucial factor in indicating recovery or not. And consequently, the government is not going to take a hands-off approach to housing and to the buying and purchasing of housing and the building of housing. No, by no means, because the housing and the building of housing is crucial to the economic system. So consequently, it will create perks and other kinds of things to try to generate the increased development of housing and building.
You don't have no balance unless you have the two of them working together for the balance and harmony of the universe. All praise is due to Allah. We're on the one God, and we're on the fact that we always believed in that one God. And so there in the holy city of Abydos, at the sacred temple of Seti I, in the so-called hieroglyphics or in the Medunetta, we find the first creation story where the God, the black God, what kind of God?
Black.
Where the black God, Ptah, through authoritative utterance and divine will and creative force and power, gave utterance and called and willed the universe into existence. And so the Holy Quran says that he said, Kun fayakun. Kun fayakun. Be, and it is. Be, and it is. Kun fayakun. And the Bible says, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, and he said, let there be this, and let there be that, and let there be light, and there was light. And the light, it says, then began to harmonize with the darkness. So let there be light. Kun fayakun, be, and it is the authoritative utterance that the Africans, do you read in the hieroglyphics or the Medunetta, that Ptah Hotep, through authoritative utterance, willed and called the universe into existence.
Yes,
in another part of Africa, we called him Amen. In another part of Africa, we called him Amun-Ra. In another part of Africa, we call him Aten. All over Africa, we believe in the one God. We have always believed in the one God, the one power and force behind the universe. The white man ain't never had to teach us nothing about no God. White folks don't believe in no God. The only God that the white man believes in is himself. When he says on the back of the dollar bill, in God we trust, it's him that he's trusting in. When it was time to go and raid Noriega in Panama, he didn't call a meeting of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and the Negro Uncle Tom boot-licking, butt-licking puppet Colin Powell, the Negro and his staff, and call them all in and say, we're getting ready to attack Panama. Let us bow our heads and say a word of prayer. Do you think Bush did that? Do you think he said, Our Father, who art in heaven? Do you think he did that? When he got ready to attack Brother Maurice Bishop, the leader of the New Jewel Movement in Grenada, do you think Reagan and the boys called a meeting of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and spent it in Congress and had a moment of prayer before they did it? No, and if they did, they were doing it to themselves.
That's right.
They said, load up the troops, the guns, and the ammunition, and let us go.
That's right.
When it's time to launch one of their spaceships, they don't say, let us bow our heads. They say, 10, 9, 8, 7, 6. They start the countdown and counting, right? He believes in no God except himself.
That's right.
And so he will make up for mystery, God, but then he'll give you a son that looks like him, with blonde hair, blue eyes, and pale skin, and tell you that if you see the Son, you've seen the Father, because the Father is in the Son, and the Son is in the Father. So if you see a white man as the Son, your subconscious has to suggest to you that the Father must be white some kind of way, also to produce a boy like that. Your mind has to say that to you. And here, as we look at it, we again have always believed in one God. In fact, all of the other people of the earth get their religion from us. The black, the brown, the red, the yellow, all of them get their religion from us. I got a bag back there with a big book in it that I need right at the table. It's in the kitchen, I think. Brother Jamal knows where it is. No matter what land you go to, they believed in what we had given to them. You go among the Mexican-speaking people, they believe in a black savior, a black messiah, who has a strange set of circumstances surrounding his origin into the world, who comes from a black Mary or a black Madonna. I just need the book out. I didn't want to give Pier 1's a plug up here. Pier 1 Imports a plug up here. Among the Greeks and the Romans, they always believed in a god that we had given to them. In Greece, it was Zeus, and Zeus was a black god. In Greece, they also had Apollo. You get to the Apollo Theater in New York. They had Apollo. Apollo was a black god. In Rome, they even worshipped a black woman as the goddess of Rome, Isis. In France, they worshipped her, because when you study the etymological root of the term Paris and Paris in French, you will find that it is linked to the root of the name Isis, and that at one time the city, back down the wheel of time, came from the name Isis. I'm talking about Paris. You had Fuhai of China, Zaha of Japan, and I mentioned those who speak Spanish. You had Quetzalcoatl. You had Krishna of India, which means the blue or the black-skinned one, blue-black-skinned one, or the purple-skinned one, Krishna of India. And you see many groups of white people throughout America today who worship the black god Krishna. You see them with their head shaved and a little ponytail or a little ponytail, running up and down the street, beating a gong and hollering, Hare, Hare, Hare Krishna, whatever the hell they say. They believe in a black god from India named Krishna. Everywhere you went in the world, Zeus, Apollo, Krishna, Buddha, all of them black. So we gave religion to the world. We gave morality to the world. We gave ethics to the world. We believed in an ancient system of morality and ethics and spirituality called in Kemet, Mayat. Mayat, truth, justice, order, harmony, balance, and reciprocity. Mayat. And the meiotic balance that black people had in the black nation, in the black society, is what attracted the white people of Europe to follow this moral code called Mayat. Now, we who follow the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, and I bring you greetings today from his spiritual son and his representative in our midst, the man who is the fulfiller of his work and the extension of his work, the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan. I bring you greetings from him of Assalamu Alaikum. When you study these two men, the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, or the Most Honorable Elijah Muhammad, and the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan, you will find that they teach us of a book that is called the Old Testament, the Torah, and they teach us of the Injil, or the Bushra, or the New Testament, or the Good News, or the Gospel. They teach us of this entire book called the Bible, but we don't study this book.
All's my life I had to fight, nigga. All's my life I hard times like, yeah. Bad trips like, yeah. Nazareth. I'm fucked up, homie, you fucked up. But if God got us, then we gon' be alright.
Nigga, we gon' be alright. Nigga, we gon' be alright. We gon' be alright. Do you hear me? Do you feel me? We gon' be alright. Nigga, we gon' be alright. Huh? We gon' be alright. Nigga, we gon' be alright. Do you hear me? Do you feel me? We gon' be alright.
And when I wake up, I recognize you looking at me for the pay cut. Bahamas, I be looking at you from the face down. One Mac 11, even boom with the face down. Skimming, and let me tell you about my life. Painkillers only put me in the twilight. With pretty pussy and Benjamin, it's the highlight. Now tell my mama I love her, but this what I like, Lord knows. 20 of them in my Chevy, tell them all to come and get me. Reaping everything I sow, so my karma come in heaven. No preliminary hearings on my record. I'm a motherfucking gangster, and silence for the record. Tell the world I know it's too late. Boys and girls, I think I've gone crazy. Trying to side my vices all day. Won't you please believe when I say, when you know we've been hurt, been down before. Nigga, when our pride was low, looking at the world like, where do we go? Nigga, and we hate.